up this week on Breaking Badness. Today we discuss Too Legit to Quit. Hackers exploit popular document publishing sites for phishing attacks. Next up, under safe lock and key, hackers found a way to open any of 3 million hotel key card locks in seconds. And of course, our fun game, Gold Guidance and Grievances. With that, Breaking Badness is next. Welcome to Breaking Badness, episode number 184, recorded on March 25th, 2024. I'm your co-host, Callie, Safe Locker Room Talk Fencil. With me is co-host Tim. You've got the encryption key to my heart, Helming. And last but not least, Austin. You down with DDP? Yeah, you know me, Northcutt. Welcome, everybody.
I think it works best if we all chorus the "you know me, yeah, you know me" part together.
Yeah, you
together.
Know me.
I'm proud I got a chuckle out of Callie on that one.
That's always the goal.
I'm impressed. And you know what? I was also chuckling because I was like, I was considering using that those lyrics as the name of the episode.
Austin, by the way, you know, I don't know if you have heard prior episodes where the following happens, but we always like it when Callie is cracked up by her own funny name. Like, that's my favorite version of that lead-in.
I don't know if I've heard it with Callie's. I've heard it with Taylor's gotten her a few times.
Yep. Yeah, he's been on a roll for a few weeks with his funny name. I'm very proud of him.
Yep.
But yeah, we're joined by Austin today as Taylor is out. He is with our team at FIC in France this week. So we are lucky to be joined by Austin. So that's fun.
Bonjour.
Bonjour. Have fun
Bonjour
on your trip.
Tout le monde en Lille. Well,
oui, la bibliothèque. You've never been?
I've never been to FIC. And I don't think I've been to the city of Lille either.
Yeah, we'll have to hear all about it from Taylor when he comes back.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, brings up that line from Home Alone. Have fun on your trip. Bring me back something French. So yeah, that's good. But yeah, we're gonna talk with Austin today about what I have called. I've named this this story too legit to quit. Which is about threat actors who are leveraging digital document publishing sites to carry out phishing, credential harvesting, and session token theft. It underscores yet again how repurposing legitimate services can be used for malicious ends. So, Austin, can you share with our audience what exactly are digital document publishing or DDP services?
Sure. DDP services allow users to upload and share PDF files in a browser-based or interactive flipbook format beyond your standard boring PDF, adds page flip animations and kind of other visual effects to a catalog or like a brochure or magazine. Kind of if you want to think about it in simple terms, DDP services allow organizations or individuals to give those, you know, instruction manuals or marketing materials that little pizzazz that makes people say things like, you know, goddamn, Jimmy, this is some serious gourmet shit when they look at it.
Oh, yeah. Like I've seen, you know, those specific sites where it's just like, oh, the page turns by itself. It's like magic. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, so, it just makes it a little prettier.
Yeah, it's a very fun user experience. So, so who would typically be using these services? Like, who's the target audience?
I mean, tons of companies are using these services to publish their documents, manuals, training manuals. Just from a little bit of internet research, I saw the names of several major brands using DDP services. One company in particular listed a major U.S. airline, along with an international cosmetics company, popular jewelry companies as well. You know, I think it might be easier to think about who isn't using these services. They're pretty simple to set up. There are a lot of them, and they're being used by organizations of all sizes and in a variety of industries, from, you know, your major brands to local municipalities.
Gotcha. And I just asked because, like, in the article, some of the different platforms listed, I hadn't heard of them before. Like, but would, you know, like a, you know, the Adobe suite fit into that at all?
You know, I'm not sure. I think they could, but these are definitely your software as a service stuff, all web-based, and then they're also going to be kind of self-hosted.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Okay. So how do threat actors exploit DDP services?
So the threat actors are repurposing the legitimate services for their own malicious ends. They're using platforms like Flipsnack, Mark, and Simple Booklet to carry out phishing attacks, credential harvesting attacks, and even things like session token theft. The DDP sites are integrated into the attack chain, typically is as a secondary step or measure. So the primary measure might be a malicious link that's associated with a certain website, kind of like, oh, click here for an instruction manual. That's really like an ad on the website. You might see a phishing email that directs the potential victim to that DDP service. To understand their manual. But typically, most of these services are hosting an embedded link within the document that leads to kind of the malicious content. And the DDP document serves as a gateway to an external adversary-controlled site that is either accessed by directly clicking on the link included in the decoy file, or through a series of redirects that require things like CAPTCHA solving to kind of thwart that automated analysis. But I think what they're really exploiting here is the positive reputation of the DDP service provider's infrastructure reputation. So, you know, that infrastructure is trusted to some degree as a safe place where documents should or could be hosted. And the threat actors are really abusing that trust in using these services as a means to bypass enterprise content filters and controls. I would say, as Craig Jackson, who's a security researcher at Cisco Talos, that kind of jumped in on this and initially published the report around this research, hosting phishing lures on DDP sites increases the likelihood of a successful phishing attack. Since these sites are often have a favorable reputation, they're unlikely to appear on web filter blacklist and may instill that false sense of security in users who recognize these websites as familiar or legitimate.
Man, I'm so tired of bad actors taking advantage of trust. When are they going to stop doing that? But so this article mentioned that, you know, the attackers take advantage of the fact, like you had mentioned, they take advantage of trust and the fact that DDP sites facilitate transient file hosting. And I was hoping, could you elaborate on what transient file hosting is for our listeners?
Absolutely. So as the word transient implies, the services, the files that are hosted on these DDP services are only available for a limited time, and then they're automatically taken down or removed by the DDP provider, not because of maliciousness, but really because of a time that's been set, or they're taking it down because a free trial has ended. Many of these services offer a free tier or no-cost trial period where a defined number of files can be published for a limited amount of time. The no-cost trial period ends, and usually, you know, then everything becomes inaccessible. The documents are removed from the website. But, you know, these no-cost trial periods require limited personal identifiers and sometimes no payment methods. And threat actors are adept at quickly creating. Yeah, seriously. But, you know, they're quick and they're able to quickly create multiple free accounts, and they can use, you know, multiple lures within those accounts too. I would say, you know, the transient nature of these free trial period actually plays into the threat actor's advantage, because the published files containing their IOCs disappear at the end of the trial period, and the threat actors don't have to worry about removing the malicious files themselves. This also reduces the chances that security researchers who are overly curious like myself will be able to access the documents and scrutinize the lure themes or the domains that are being used to direct and deliver those malware payloads.
Yeah, and you can correct me if I'm wrong in this assumption, but as I'm reading this, you know, it felt like this is like the Snapchat for, you know, bad actors, you know, when everything has an expiration date on it and can disappear. Do you feel like that's not a very good comparison?
I think it is a good comparison to the average person. You know, I think if someone is really eager and they can figure out a way to contact the DDP website and, you know, compel them to, you know, release the document XYZ that, you know, if they have enough of the right information can explain what was going on, maybe they could get it back. Like, I would assume it's stored somewhere.
Yeah.
Even if it's deleted from the individual free trial account, like, I would tend to guess it's probably stored somewhere. But, you know, just like with Snapchat, it's probably stored somewhere.
Yeah, I was wondering if it would I would agree with that. It's probably stored somewhere. And I was wondering, like, could those logs maybe be pulled at some point for further analysis by researchers?
If the DDP company is willing to share that with researchers, I'm sure it could be. But, you know, I think the researchers have to make a compelling case to that company to say, hey, share this information, or we've identified this or that. Otherwise, from the company standpoint, they might look at it as like, why am I letting you into my client's files?
True.
Yeah, my guess is it would be a pretty steep hill to climb to get them to agree to that, but it would be useful from a forensic perspective for sure.
Absolutely. So, you know, how can defenders better prepare for these kinds of attacks, and what can users do on their end to defend themselves?
You know, this is a tough one. One thing that comes to mind, and I think we've talked about this as an organization before when it comes to domains. The domains that are being inserted into these published files may have been created, but may not be active or resolving when they're initially published. So even if these DDP providers are scanning the documents for potentially malicious links, there might not be any information around some of these domains because they're just being parked, or they haven't been purchased yet, or they're planning to go back in and revise the malicious domain once it's kind of originally been published. But kind of some things that the enterprise or common end user could do, from an enterprise standpoint, you know, block common DDP sites via your border security devices. You know, use those EDRs, put in place web content filtering and or security, DNS security controls if access to these sites is not required for normal business operations. And part of that would be determining whether or not these sites are necessary for business continuity. I would say, you know, in some organizations, people are going to say, we need that. But is the common inconvenience worth the great risk is always kind of my thought.
Always the question, right?
Like, if I delayed somebody a few minutes from accessing that site, and I'm sorry, like, oh, now you have to put in a request to get access to it, but let's be able to take a look at it by our experts first.
This is where some of the analytics stuff could be potentially helpful too. Like, if you're seeing a pattern where, for example, you know, a given user is accessing those sites pretty much continuously throughout a 24-hour cycle, that looks funny compared to mainly accessing it during work hours. But you know, who has time to set that up?
But that's funny, Tim. That was one of the other recommendations I had is for the SOC analyst, monitor for behavioral trends within your organization's internal environment. Those trends might indicate like a coordinated malicious attacker activity that's targeting your organization specifically. Yeah. As the analyst, if you see the unusual amounts of traffic between your network and a DDP site and that anomaly is spiked, maybe it's worth investigating what prompted that increase. Was there, you know, an email chain? Start reaching out to your end users. Figure out why is everyone going here today?
Yeah. And do you, in fact, even know that you're going there? Or is that some kind of automated thing by some mid-stage tooling that's using it?
Exactly. And then, you know, the other thing you could look at is email controls that are configured to detect and alert for links in emails containing like a DDP site URL. And of course, always leverage threat intelligence to quickly identify newly created sites related to known threats. In this case, a lot of the new DDP sites that may be leveraged by these threat actors. So are you observing, looking at those newly observed or newly active domains that are appearing and are located within some of these DDP documents? And of course, update your security or your end user awareness.
Of course, of course. That's all great. Thank you so much, Austin, for walking us through that. I'm going to take us into the next portion, which is our hoodie rating. So if you're a newer listener, after we talk about a particular article, we will assign it a hoodie rating, if you can picture the stereotypical hacker in a hoodie. So we range from 1 to 10, 10 being the worst possible case scenario, end of days, do not pass go or collect $200. And then 1 is not so bad. We can keep on trucking, not so bad. So I'm going to start with Tim, actually. So having heard Austin walk us through this article and his thoughts, what would you rank this type of attack as from 1 to 10 hoodies?
Yeah, this is going to be an interesting one to watch. And I'm somewhere in the middle of the scale because I don't know how widespread it is right now and how hard it is ultimately to be thwarted. Austin gave some great advice for defenders. There are things that you can do. You know, sometimes where it's really hard is if you get an attack vector for which the indicators are not readily available, and you don't have a clear sense of what to look for. And this one is it's kind of in between that way. You know, one of the things that we've seen threat actors do for a long time is using legitimate infrastructure for their command and control. So like there were malware variants whose names unfortunately escape me at the moment, but that used Twitter accounts actually as command and control. Very few enterprises are going to block that particular social media service, whatever name it has. And so this is a way that that command and control could sometimes proceed kind of unimpeded. And so this reminds me of that a little bit. It's not the same mechanism, but it's kind of a similar idea where you're going to use allowed infrastructure as part of the command and control process. But importantly, as Austin pointed out, there are then other domains that are part of the attacker-controlled infrastructure, and that is something that there are ways to solve for. So for now, I'm just going to put this right in the middle and give it a 5, and we'll have to see what happens.
All right. That seems pretty fair. Austin, do you feel similarly at a 5, or what are you thinking?
I'm definitely in the same range as Tim. From a cybersecurity or like cybercrime perspective, I think I'm going to give it a 6. But that's with the caveat that this is really a low skill. Like it's not difficult to set this up, which can make it enticing to all levels of threat actors. But I think that it has the potential to be a nasty delivery vector. If the right, or well, I guess the wrong threat actor begins to exploit it and exploits it well. So if they can identify a very convincing lure theme, or if they really start to gear it towards their targets, I think it could be a malicious or very effective means of initial attack or initial compromise.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and we'll probably see at least some of that, I would guess.
Oh, yeah. I think I don't think this is the last time we'll talk about this on this podcast, unfortunately. But yeah, thank you so much to both of you for your hoodie ratings. And thanks, Austin, for walking us through that. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to discuss under safe lock and key, where we're going to talk about some physical hacking. So stay tuned and we'll be right back.
Hi there, Breaking Badness friends and family. Colonel Panic, or Tim, here from the team. If this is your first time hearing our production, welcome aboard. If you're a longtime listener, you can't be a first-time caller because we don't do that. But what you can do is leave us a 5-star rating and, if you're feeling extra ambitious, a review wherever you get your podcasts. And for new and returning listeners alike, tell a friend if you're enjoying what you're hearing. Thanks a bunch, and now let's get back to the show.
All right, and we're back. Everybody have a nice refreshing break?
Oh, it was so relaxing.
Good, good. That's what we aim for.
Drink of water.
Good. Yeah. I'm so happy. So we haven't discussed much in the way of physical hacking in a while. So we are gonna discuss.
You mean how, like, hacking things with a machete?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought that was what we were gonna talk about. Awesome. It's fun.
It falls under the hacking umbrella. So mm-hmm.
The hacking umbrella. Hey, that should be a piece of swag that we give out, because oh,
you can hack an umbrella
in Seattle.
Oh yeah,
or the umbrella that you use for hacking.
Yeah, for sure. Oh man, I really like that idea, because I still
is the
have...
tip like a USB port.
Yes.
Oh my goodness.
Instead of the old, like, you know, needle, it's now a USB port.
This is kind of like a fancy technological Mary Poppins umbrella.
Mm-hmm.
I'm into it. I feel like we could do that. We could have an umbrella, and that's definitely some swag I would use regularly. So I'm going to make a note to myself.
What better way to start social engineering than to invite somebody to share your umbrella during a rainstorm and then start social engineering them?
I know. It's like it could be a meet cute
that's right.
Yeah, goes horribly wrong. Well, this novel's just writing itself. It's fun. But we're gonna actually, you know, we're not talking about hacking with a machete, unfortunately, and we're not talking about, like, hacking up a long. We're gonna talk about hackers who have found a way to open any of 3 million hotel key card locks in seconds, which, you know, doesn't matter how you identify. Male, female, non-binary. I don't really want anybody in my hotel room.
No, I mean, that sounds kind of bad. And yeah. It's worth talking about.
Yeah. So to begin, this article mentions how thousands of security researchers descend upon Las Vegas for Hacker Summer Camp in August. And it's likely that they will experiment with hacking the infrastructure in Vegas. So
what she means is guaranteed.
Yeah.
Of course.
But so I actually haven't been to Hacker Summer Camp yet. So, but the conference is always held in Vegas, to my understanding. But I'm assuming the city hasn't found that curiosity to be too troublesome yet.
I mean, I think there's always a certain amount of, like, buckle up, here they come, trepidation around it. And there have been certain kinds of shenanigans dating back to, you know, the beginning of, you know, I don't know. Let's see. This was just DEF CON 31, I think, that we had in 2023. So they've been around for quite a long time. And yeah, there's been various stuff that goes on there. In fact, I will mention that one of our own Intrepid Domain Tools people may or may not have successfully copied hotel keys using a Flipper Zero. I hasten to add that if that happened, it would have been their own keys, not somebody else's. And that way they had a spare in the form of their Flipper Zero, you know, in case they lost their regular key. That's not exactly what we're talking about, but in a way, it's kind of in the same neighborhood. But this story is different from that, as we're about to find out.
As a side note, that is, you know, to use that for good in case you lose your key, that's pretty ingenious.
There's actually a lot of pretty cool things that you can do with those things.
That's cool. Yeah. I'd love, yeah, we should talk about that more offline.
Yeah, we could do a whole episode about the Flipper Zero and
maybe we should
types of devices.
Yeah, maybe we actually should. I got a lot of notes to jot down for myself.
There would be a lot of movie references there, though.
Excellent. That's ripe for Breaking Badness, though. So researchers mentioned in this article, they were actually tasked with finding vulnerabilities in hotel room gadgets, and one of them being, you know, the room's door. And they found a vulnerability in several models of the SafeLock brand RFID-based key card locks. So, Tim, what can you tell us about SafeLock?
Yeah, so you're right. These researchers, they were basically invited to red team a room and all of its contents. And so a lot like real red teams, the objective was to find security flaws so that the customer or hotel that invited them there or whatever could be aware of those things and start doing something about them. So now, as for SafeLock itself, well, that's a sub-brand of a Swiss company called Dormabaca, which I personally had never heard of either of those names before I saw this article. But then I've never been specifically a physical security expert. But according to the article that we're linking to in the show notes that we're referencing here, these things are installed on, as you mentioned, around 3 million doors worldwide, and that's in 13,000 properties in 131 countries. So pretty big attack surface we're talking about here.
Yeah, absolutely. And the two of the researchers who discovered these vulnerabilities, Ian Carroll and Leonard, do you think it's Wouters or Wouters?
I would say Wouters is my best guess. And sorry, Leonard, if you're hearing this and we're butchering it, we apologize.
We absolutely apologize. We take name pronunciation very seriously here on Breaking Badness. Says me, Callie Funsel, a.k.a. Kaylee Finkel. So they walked through the steps of how they were able to do this. Can you briefly describe those steps for our listeners?
Yes. Here is how to get into any locked door in any hotel. Get your pencils out. No. So first, they need an existing key so they could book a room in the hotel and use that, or snag a key card from a drop-off box, or pick up one that fell on the floor, whatever. Okay, so then comes the, as the article says, $300 RFID read-write device, which I think we're thinking of as a Flipper Zero, and then reading a certain code from that card. And as an aside, I keep talking about the Flipper Zero, and it's kind of the new hotness these days, but they point out that other devices like the Proxmark 3 or an NFC-capable Android phone can also do this. Okay, so they read the card, then they write two key cards of their own, and when they tap those two cards on a lock, the first one rewrites part of the lock's data, and the second one actually opens the door, and Bob's your uncle at that point. I also want to mention that Leonard Wouters pointed out that this allows one to open any door in the hotel. So we're all thinking of the guest rooms, but if you think about it, there are a lot of places in a hotel where unauthorized entry could be, let's say, problematic. So keep that in mind as we think about this whole problem.
Oh, I definitely wasn't even thinking about the other possibilities. I was just thinking about the guest rooms.
Any door in the hotel.
Oh. Yeah, this just got a lot worse.
Ooh, boy. Obviously, they're just trying to get into the pool after hours, I would assume.
Or the gym,
yeah.
Yeah.
Pools in hotels are often closed like way earlier than they should be. That's my grievance.
Yeah. That may not be true in Vegas. Everything's 24 hours in Vegas.
No,
but maybe
pool,
it is true there.
No, the pools often in Vegas close at like 6 p.m. because they want you to be gambling.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, but what about the rest of us that...
Waterproof slot machines, that's obviously the answer.
There you go. See, we're solving Vegas. So this article mentions that the technique to hack the locks, like you had mentioned, it's the two vulnerabilities. So one, you know, reads the lock and then the other one opens it. So I guess my question is, do both of those vulnerabilities have to be present, or can one exist without the other? Like what were kind of those findings?
No, these two components, but they sort of go with each other. Like these are the components that you need to actually have these locks and have them work. But yeah, so let's go into a little more detail. So Dormakaba uses a key derivation function, or KDF as we'll call it henceforth, to derive the encryption keys for some of the SafeLock MyFair Classic key cards. And that's one of the product lines in a very old product line made by a company called NXP. So this KDF, key derivation function, only uses the card's unique identifier, which is just a string of characters, right, as an input. So they were able to crack the KDF. Okay, cool. But they have to be able to write a card. And so this is where two kinds of engineering, the social kind and the reverse kind, enter the picture. So they got copies of this hotel front desk software by, guess what, just asking the manufacturer. And then with that in hand, they were able to reverse engineer that, which allowed them to know all of the data that's stored on the cards, which includes a hotel property code as well as a code for each individual door or room. And at that point, they can then create their own values and encrypt them in the same way that Dormakaba's system would. So it's worth reiterating that it's pretty trivial, like I said up front, to make a copy of a single key card. And so the scary thing here is now they can write arbitrary master keys, skeleton keys, whatever you want to call them, to get in everywhere.
Yeah, I thought the most interesting part of that was that they just asked the manufacturer. And it's just one of those things where you don't know unless you ask. So, mm-hmm. Yeah. Indeed. So how has Dormakaba responded to these findings?
Yeah, so the good thing here is that, like, there's a lot that's, in a weird way, that's good about this story, in the sense that it all began with a sanctioned sort of pen testing type of activity, and this was responsible disclosure, and the vendor has been responsive. Those are all things we want to see when a vulnerability is announced. This red teaming itself occurred in 2022, so it wasn't during just this most recent hacker summer camp, and the vendor has helped customers update millions of locks since then. Fortunately, in many cases, but not all cases, that update does not require a hardware change to the locks. But they're going to need to, the affected hotels or whatever other companies are going to have to update or replace the so-called front desk management system. And they're going to have one of their technicians reprogram each lock door by door. So cumulatively speaking, that's a lot of person hours. And as of when we're recording this podcast, the report is that the estimate is somewhere around 36% of the affected locks have been upgraded.
Oh, I feel like technician rates just went up.
Yeah, right.
I know. I'm just thinking about, like, if I was the technician, all the podcasts I'd listen to while I was doing that. Probably this
That's
one.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I guess my question, after, hearing about these findings is, do you think anybody is going through all these steps to open a hotel door? Because I've seen a lot of videos online of people who just use the old hanger trick. And that seems to work just fine. And it's fewer steps, and a hanger isn't $300. So,
right. So, well, it's always worth recalling that it's kind of similar to 0 days. Like you keep stuff in your back pocket until you actually need to use that technique. And there's so many ways to get into a room. You got your aforementioned coat hangers, simple social engineering, stealing somebody's card, flipper zeroing it by just being close to it without actually touching it, which is why I carry an RFID-proof wallet, by the way, which was long before we knew about this particular story. I may or may not have tested that feature with a colleague who may or may not have brought a flipper zero to Hacker Summer Camp. But as I mentioned, as we're talking about here, it's not just the guest rooms that are involved. Now, if you want to get into, let's say a back office or something of the hotel, That can be social engineered too, right? There's other ways to do that. I mean, if you've got a safety vest and a clipboard, boy, you can get by a lot of questions. If you're wandering around a place exploring what you can get into, if you wear a suit similar to what the employees wear at the hotel and you got a little name tag of that hotel, well, that may also help you get in places that you're not supposed to. So this certainly is not the only way to get into places where people don't want to. And, you know, if you follow folks like Deviant Olive, you've seen lots of examples of getting into all kinds of spaces for many years before this was known about. So you're exactly right about that, Callie, but this is a pretty significant one for us to know about.
Absolutely. Another, maybe it's probably a less expensive one too, is the ladder trick. Is I've heard people just carrying around a ladder. Don't question it.
Yep. Nope. Yeah. Clipboards, ladders, you know. I know a guy who has a white van or a white truck, I guess, and he's got an for official use only sticker stuck on the side of it. And boy, that's just amazing where he can park.
That's genius.
Yeah, it's not actually imitating any agency or anything like that. It just says for official use only.
And people just are like, I accept that. So you mentioned only about a third of the locks have been updated at this point to mitigate this vulnerability, and it's going to take some time to update those remaining locks. What can hotel guests, and, you know, now that we've pointed out, it's not just guests, it's, you know, hotels themselves with their, you know, secure rooms that need to be protected. What can, you know, everybody do in the meantime for protection?
Well, if you're a hotel guest, just stay home for Pete's sake.
That makes sense.
No, or you can use the chain when you're inside your room and you don't want one of these folks coming in. Well, you use the chain, you use that flip over metal thing. I don't know what that's called. The alternative to the chain. It probably has a name that would work well as a crossword puzzle entry, I suspect. Now, those things do only work when you're in the room, unless you're able to use the force. So if you're concerned about so-called evil maids and theft of your valuables and all that, then you do have to be really careful and think a lot about what you leave in your room when you're not there, unfortunately.
The name of the device you're talking about is a swing bar, too.
A swing bar.
Okay.
I thought that was something I used on the playground when I was a kid, but okay, a swing bar.
Multi-purpose.
Mm-hmm.
We learn something new every day. I'm gonna impress
a lot
of folks.
We certainly strive to.
Yeah. You have to definitely watch what you leave in your room. When you're in your room, if you're like me, you just shove a heavy chair in front of the door.
That reminds me of the chair blocking the door scene from The Big Lebowski. Absolute classic.
Classic. All right. Well, thank you, Tim, for walking us through that particular scenario. We're heading into the hoodie rating territory of this segment. So we started with you first last time, and now I'm going to ask Austin to go first. After listening to Tim give us an overview of this, what are you thinking, Austin?
I think for this one, I'm going to go a little bit lower with a 3 hoodie. Although, you know, it bothers my physical security knowing that these are so vulnerable and that even after 2 years, only about a third of the locks have been updated or patched. But I think it requires it's an odd attempt or an odd vector that someone's going to go after. And I think it also would have to be kind of like bad luck. Like once it's exploited once at a hotel, I would imagine that, you know, hotel management's going to patch it. So it's like, are you going to just happen to be at the hotel at the wrong time?
Are you going to be at the
wrong
time?
Yeah, that's a pretty
time?
Good incentive for them to fast track that upgrade if they actually get owned that way.
And I would imagine it would be like a smash and grab operation of like, all right, we're going to hit this hotel and, you know, do it once and we get out.
Yeah. And the challenge there, of course, is it's probably going to be hard for the hotels to figure out. I don't know whether the logs would probably be able to somehow indicate that what had been used for access was a general purpose generic master key, but I don't know. I don't know if they'd be able to tell for sure that this is how somebody gained unauthorized access to that room.
Gotcha. Tim, are you feeling similarly to Austin in three hoodies, or are you feeling a little higher, a little lower?
Yeah, no, I'm kind of in the same neighborhood. I mean, and it's partly because of what you talked about before, which is cold comfort, right? There are lots of ways to get into these rooms. You don't have to rely on this, which weirdly is sort of disquieting and also has the effect of lowering the relative risk associated with this specific item. What the heck, just for variety's sake, I'll go 3.5 hoodies.
Excellent. Got a half hoodie there.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, that's something else for us all to be afraid of.
As if there weren't enough.
I know. Yeah, but I take comfort, or I don't know if you call it comfort, but like we said, there's a lot of different ways to get into the room. Just keep your valuables on your person if you can. Or, I'm sure there's lots of different ways to keep these things safe that we could talk about on another episode. If we wanted to talk about the Flipper Zero, we could probably also talk about the ways that we could keep these things safe.
How to do really good physical security is always a good topic.
Yeah, let's definitely talk about that, especially as, you know, we're ramping up to conference season very quickly here. So maybe that'll be a good episode we should do. So everybody stay tuned for that. I'm saying it out loud to hold myself accountable. All right. Well, thanks, Tim. We are going to, end things now with our gold guidance and grievances before we exit. So if you're a newer listener to the show, we like to end with what we call gold guidance and grievances, which is pretty similar to how it sounds, where we share a piece of good news, any advice we have, and then anything that's bothering us, either within the industry or not. Doesn't have to be. It's great if it is, but, you know, depends on how we're feeling that week. And we also start with the grievance and work our way back to the gold because we like to end things on a happier note. So I am going to start with Austin. What are you thinking, gold guidance and grievances, not in that order?
All right. So ironically, my grievance had to do with the SafeLock vulnerability and the number of hotels impacted worldwide, just because, you know, we want to feel safe when we travel. And, you know, hotel owners, hotel chains, please patch those, for the well-being and just sense of mind of your security-conscious guest. Guidance also was going to be SafeLock related and saying that always engage that swing bar or take some measures to kind of maybe do things in your room that aren't so obvious, that if someone were to enter your room that shouldn't have, they might not notice, whether it's putting shoes in a certain direction that if they trip on them and even if they reset them, are they exactly the way they were? Take a picture of it before you leave. And then lastly, my gold, have to applaud. The EU is attempting to bolster their anti-money laundering regulations and laws. I say attempting, it's not an easy task. I have some friends who work in the AML enforcement field, and I know it's a challenging task, but always support regulations that are going to attempt to curb it. This one is specifically directed at cryptocurrency and anonymous wallets. Although, as we know, working with a lot of Whois data here at Domain Tools, even things with names on them aren't actually the real person's identity. So, but in the end, I applaud the EU on trying to kind of step up their anti-cryptocurrency money laundering regulations.
Excellent.
I'm with you. That is a good thing.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing, Austin. Tim, what about you and your gold guidance and grievances?
Not in that order.
Not in that order.
So my grievance, well, some folks may have seen the story about a new app at Fresno High School, Fresno, California. What does this app do? Well, it tracks student bathroom visits. Yeah.
What? Mm-hmm. I don't love that.
You don't love that? Yeah, you're not alone. As somebody, we were talking about this on one of our internal Slack channels at Domain Tools, and as somebody pointed out, well, this is basically training for when you become an Amazon warehouse employee. But yeah, so that's a real nasty development, and we certainly hope we don't see that spread.
As a former high school teacher, I can understand the thought process behind it, but I'm very surprised that it actually got all the way to an execution phase.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And yes, I spent some time as a public school teacher too, and you can maybe relate to this, Austin. Nothing is more demoralizing as a teacher than when you get through some stellar explanation of something that you just feel like went over so well. You ask for hands and you get a raised hand, and then what the student says is, "Can I go to the bathroom?"
It's just all too many times.
One of those moments. Yeah. All right. So that's my grievance. My guidance is, you know, we inhabit DNS world here, and it's complicated, and there is a lot of terminology, and I know a lot of really smart people that are practitioners in security and whatnot who still are not absolutely fluent in everything DNS, and how could you be? You know, there's so much to keep track of in security world. But if you are wanting to brush up on making sure you're up to date on DNS terminology, there's an RFC for you. RFC 9499 actually exists to address this problem because DNS is described in so many other RFCs that you would have to individually go through. So this takes all of that terminology and puts it right in one place. So well done, authors of RFC 9499. And that would be P. Hoffman of ICANN and K. Fujiwara of JPRS. And I should probably know their first names, but I don't, so apologies for that. Okay, and then my gold has to do with Rust, the programming language, and the Serbian Registry of Internet Domain Names, or RNIDS, which is responsible for the .rs top-level domain. Now, you might expect that possibly Serbia wouldn't be so happy about the amount of Rust language work that uses .rs, but in fact, nothing could be further from the truth. And so they actually sent a letter where their chairman said, you know what, we're big fans of Rust, and we are happy to have you use the .rs TLD, and we recognize how important, what contributions Rust has made in the internet and other technology. So they totally embrace it. So that's really pretty cool. They are friends of Rust, and I enjoyed seeing that. So there's my gold.
Excellent. These are great gold guidance and grievances. Thank you both for sharing. Well, we have come to the end of our journey on episode 184.
Hard to believe.
I know, right? It just flies by. But I really thank you both for being here today. Austin, thank you so much for stepping in for Tay while he is at FIC in France. I'm sure we're going to be seeing a lot more of you, though, on the show, which is exciting. It's great to have people like you and Ian and Sean and just everybody that we've got on our bench ready to, you know, come on and be with us at Breaking Badness. So thank you.
A formidable bench indeed.
Yeah.
I'm glad I could come off the bench during March Madness for Tay.
Yeah, so. That's right. Yeah, I forgot to even give any reference to March Madness, but there is a lot of madness.
You know, I wanted to have some grievances there, but I have a policy of I don't complain about the effort that young college athletes are putting out on the court. They're trying their best. So great work to all those athletes that are competing in the tournament or that were competing in the tournament this weekend.
Yeah, for sure.
For sure. Thank you. All right. Well, thanks everybody for listening. Be sure to come back again next week for an all new episode of Breaking Badness. Stay frosty, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.
That's about all we have for this week. You can find us on Twitter, at DomainTools. All of the articles and IOCs mentioned today will be included in our blog post, which can be found at domaintools.com/resources/podcasts. Catch us every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Pacific time when we publish our podcast and blog. We'll see you next week on another episode of Breaking Badness. Until then, remember, don't drink and click.